Welcome to episode 11 of the Over the Counter podcast. I'm Mark Giesecheck.
And I'm Andrew Whaley.
And today Andrew and I are going to talk about something that might not immediately come to your mind in terms of free association when you think about it, but we're going to talk about community and associations.
Is that what we're going to talk about? Associations.
Well, in general, yes.
Okay. Well, I think what the aspect of this that I'm interested in exploring, and I think this is where kind of a good disagreement between you and I will turn into a good podcast, is that whether or not the digitalization of community is to be equated with the depersonalization of community.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you're talking about associations and like face-to-face, geographically local, you know, meat world.
Yeah. Well, really, where this comes from my perspective, is an insight that I came across that younger people are not joining the same associations that their parents and grandparents did. And this is across the board. So whether it be church –
right.
Like, and officially being on the church membership rolls, or whether it be the Kiwanis Club, or the Knights of Columbus, or the Elks, or the Moose, or whatever, or even like alumni associations, or other types of civic associations, right? Young people in general, so we're talking, you know, I don't know, maybe under 40, under 30, whatever, are not joining those associations as their parents and grandparents did.
I can honestly say, and I'm 43 years old, and I have never – I've been Catholic actively – a three percenter, as we defined earlier. I've been an active Catholic pursuing my faith since age 24, and I was Christian, had a big Christian conversion at 18. So I've been – and I have not ever been – a member of a parish. I've never enrolled. Yeah. I've never even consistently gone to the same church for Mass. I don't think I've gone to the same church for Mass 4 or 5 Sundays in a row in the entire time I've been a Catholic. Well, I don't have a family. We don't live down the street. You go based on what you're, who you're meeting up with and what you're doing and how we single people kind of hobble community together. It's more...
You mean couple?
That's a cobble?
You said hobble.
Oh, hobble.
Hobble is what you do when you're walking with a limp.
Well, we are hobbling towards community. Our community is hobbling. But yeah, okay. we cobble community.
It's interesting that you say that, because I was going to bring up another example. I was talking to a guy who, it's kind of a long story, but like his wife is a Methodist minister, and when she retired, they decided to go to a Presbyterian church. Long story, right? Mm-hmm. Probably behind that. But they couldn't officially be on the membership rolls because she was technically still officially a Methodist minister or whatever. So they've been going to this church for like 10 years without officially being members. They're not. And so like when the new membership directory came out, they weren't in it. But apparently there's like 20 or so percent of the people who attend the church every week are also not on the membership rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because something like a church directory like clearly states who's in and who's out of the club, so to speak, by saying you're officially on the membership list or not. And by being somebody who is not interested in that kind of association, not interested in being on one of those lists, who for whom that's not important, it just kind of creates a different kind of relationship between that person and the community.
No, you're right. Right. And let's look at historically what's at stake here. The very thing that you're talking about, this voluntarily joining free associations among laity and stuff, that and even inside churches and stuff like that, the Ladies' Sodality, the, you know, the Altar Society, whatever, you know, Catholic Action, these things, this is what Alexis de Tocqueville said was one of the defining characteristics of America versus the old world,
right?
When he wrote Democracy in America, and so there's something that at our founding was something that was really at the heart of it, and like you said,
these associations
my dad is a baby boomer, and when he was my age, he was active in the Elks Lodge and the VFW and stuff like. wouldn't occur to me to join a lodge.
Right. So let's just kind of point out a couple of the things kind of along the Tocqueville lines here. So guilds used to be really important in the Middle Ages, right? And those are always associated with your profession. And of course, they expanded beyond that realm in many, many ways. But in a certain sense, I would say they're the kind of cultural roots of modern associations. But what's distinct about American associations versus what you'll find in other places, I think, is that we have these ones that are egalitarian, right? So we do have professional associations like the AMA or the ADA or the Bar Association or whatever, right?
Yeah, and I, for years, I was a member of the Specialty Coffee Association of America, which I need to rejoin.
So we do have professional associations, but we also have these other things, which we can call loosely like civic associations, some of which have stricter membership requirements like the American Legion or the VFW, where you have to be a veteran, and some of which are just totally egalitarian, where you don't have to, there are no requirements like that, like the Kiwanis Club or the Rotary Club. And those things strike me as particularly American in that everybody, whether you are an investment banker or a janitor, right, you're all entering at the same, in a certain sense, at the same level. There's something kind of special about that.
I mean, my theory on this, two things. A, from Gen X on, we defined ourselves by subculture, and the subcultures were kind of defined by either ideology or lack of ideology, right? So that's, we didn't define ourselves, and we didn't want to be egalitarian. We wanted to be with people like us, right? Now, that maybe wasn't social class. It was more ideological. We're punk rock. We're goth. We're new wave.
Whatever. But to me, though, this is like simmering all of society down to what happens in your local public high school. As if the choice you make when you're 14 years old as to which group of friends you're going to hang out then dictates your associations for the rest of your life.
No, I think you'll end up...
Which is nuts!
No, I think that you'll... Now here, I think with our generation, at least, we don't hang out with the same people that we used to hang out with.
That's true, too, right?
But the people I hang out with, I hang out with in the way that I used to. Right. I used to hang out with everybody who skated and played in punk bands and did all that stuff. Now I hang out with everybody who likes philosophy and wine and who's probably Catholic, right? But we still, Gen X is still very tribal, right? That's just, we're not egalitarian, we're tribal. And it was kind of a shift. Now then the other thing is that I think that this early influx and this defining characteristic of the association that de Tocqueville saw, and it ultimately was that egalitarianism that was the New World, kind of at the core of the New World. And I think that worked itself out so perfectly that our society became kind of egalitarian. The coffee house and the bar became kind of egalitarian. And so we don't need a society for egalitarianism anymore. We can get it by grabbing a coffee or getting a beer.
No.
Okay,
no,
good. No. Yeah, now no, we have a disagreement. No. Well, now it's going to get good.
I think the civic associations like Kiwanis or Rotary or whatever, you know, that we're trying to talk about here do level the playing field and do provide this egalitarian experience. Even church membership does that.
Yeah.
Right? Where being on the membership rolls of the church says, I'm on there.
But the topic is we don't join anymore. Why?
With people who are above and below me on the socioeconomic scale. Right. I mean, another great example of this, I think, is the idea of having an unlisted phone number. Right? Mm-hmm. It used to be expensive, right? You had to pay a fee to have your phone number unlisted, right? Not in the telephone book.
Right.
Now, anybody who's under the age of 35 or 40, right, probably doesn't have a home phone. They only have a cell phone. And from the beginning, cell phones were like this exclusive thing for rich people. Mm-hmm. So the numbers were unlisted by default. So nobody's cell phone number is in a phone book anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is the idea that what we've seen in terms of the cultural shift away from these egalitarian civic associations toward what you're calling a sort of Gen X, Gen Y tribalism is actually promoting the stratification of our society.
The stratification, but it's not along the classical boundaries of class, I don't think. That's true. That's what I'm saying, is that it's egalitarian in the sense that poor people and rich people hang out now because they're both are into the same obscure band. And they talk online and nobody knows how. I mean, I don't know how much money my Facebook friends have. I don't.
Yeah.
You know, it's not. Class isn't as important as far as money goes, at least not with my generation. It doesn't seem like. And the other thing is that I think that this movement away from, I think you hit it on something beautiful, a perfect metaphor, the phone. Okay? The reason we don't join societies or even join a parish is because you don't call places anymore. You call people.
Yeah.
We're not homes. We're units.
Right.
You know, you don't go.
But see, for you as a single person, that sounds like a great idea, right? For me as a married person with kids, I'm thinking, well, wait a second. This means that I'm never going to have that experience of somebody calling the house and having one of my kids pick up the phone and say, oh, this call's for you, Dad. I'm never going to have that experience because people will call me directly on my cell phone.
It's inefficient.
Maybe, right? But isn't there something communal about that? Sharing a phone? I'm not saying that we all have to go back to
landline. I know, it's funny. I have a friend here in Denver that my old roommate from the religious order I was in, right? And he's a Dominican now. And so he's transferred, so he's technically in the novitiate. So he doesn't have a cell phone during that first year. So it just drives me nuts trying to make plans with him to do anything. He's out and about, and I'm trying to tell him, hey, we're not going to go to this restaurant, we're going to go someplace else, and I have to wait for him and tell him because there's no calling him, right? And then I have to call his house. If I call him, someone else answers, and I say, is Brother Reginald around?
Yeah.
Let me see if I can find him. And then they leave, and there's dead air. And I think to myself, this is just ridiculous. Why can't – I don't want to call a place. I want to call a person. And it's funny. I mean, I was 30 when I got my first cell phone. So it's not like I didn't grow up like this. I grew up calling places.
But I think email is the same way, right, or any other kind of online messaging system, where it used to be that you sent your letter to an address,
right?
And then that address would receive letters from multiple people. And then they would be distributed, right? Whether it be as small as a single family or as big as like a dormitory.
Right.
But now you send your message directly to a single person.
Right.
Which is, you know, I mean, like you said, more efficient, but is that better?
And it's funny. It's like now I've finally, I know the kids did this a long time ago, but I now, as a grown man, have gotten frustrated with how long it takes for some people to return emails. So I will text people. Because most people will shoot a quick text back. I don't want to wait. I want the information now. Hey, are you going to get wings tonight with us?
Right.
I don't want to wait for you to get around to answering your email. That's like the Pony Express or something. I want instant gratification. I want instant communication. I just want a telepathic link with everyone. And so.
Okay. So, but I think this is a good segue into trying to, you know, define the relationship between what you might call in-person, face-to-face community versus digital community.
Okay.
And, I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there right now about the use of social media and digital stuff and digital education and all this. But I guess the matter at the heart of it is, can digital community replace face-to-face community? And if not, then in what way can it supplement or help or serve face-to-face community in a way that's good? Here's a good example, right? You go to a waiting room nowadays. It used to be that you might strike up a conversation with the person next to you who's reading their magazine or whatever. Now there are no magazines, and everybody's looking at their phone and doing something on their phone. No one's talking.
But you had that conversation because you were bored and you were forced to. That's why they put magazines in there in the first place. Is so that you'd have something to stick your face in so you wouldn't have to talk to the other sick people. Because chances are they've got something you don't have and you have something they don't have.
You're assuming that doctor's waiting
around. Now we're all going to get even double sick.
What if it's the dentist, right?
Right. Or the.
I'm not saying that's wrong or something. It's just different, right? Or, I mean, there's a difference between having somebody over to your house. Mm-hmm. Pulling out your photo album and showing them pictures of your children or your vacation or whatever and having a conversation about it versus immediately posting pictures on Facebook and having people that you haven't seen in 10 years post comments.
Yeah, and you could have them over and you could milk the cow and churn some butter and put it in the ice box.
Okay, let me give you another great example, right? I teach both in the classroom and online,
right?
And there's something that happens in the classroom that doesn't happen
right.
when you're online. It's hard to define exactly what that is.
I'm with you.
Right, because we film what happens in the classroom. We put videos of me talking online. Right. But there's something that happens in the classroom that doesn't happen online. And it's so hard to put your finger on exactly what it is, right? Mm-hmm. But there's the element of peer pressure, element of community, element of making eye contact with the professor, immediacy, element of the professor being able to see that the students are confused mm-hmm. or happy or sad or tired, and then being able to respond to that.
It's whether or not you're interacting directly or through a medium. I mean, this isn't anything new. Talking to someone over a glass of wine is different than reading the letter that you wrote them. It's one-sided. If I watch your lecture, it's one-sided. You're talking at me, where even if I'm not saying anything, if I'm sitting there in front of you, you're telling me something. And right. I'm experiencing right. it as it happens, right? It's immediate in some way. And I mean, and just for the record, clearly – I value face-to-face community. My entire apostolate is built around building places that bring back face-to-face community. I don't think it can replace it in any way, shape, or form. I think it can augment it. I mean, it's a good example. I went to a very small Catholic liberal arts college, great book school. We all read the same 111 books or whatever, so we kind of have a weird kind of intellectual link. You could call it intimate and familiar, you could call it incestuous, you could call it a lot of things, arrogant, but we all speak kind of the same language and we have some of the same reference points, right? So I don't live, maybe in Denver there's 10, 15 people from our school, but online through Facebook especially, now email, but it's so atomistic with email and so confusing. When I hate email lists, older people love, but the generation above me has adopted email, but man, they love the listserv. They love lists. I hate being on email lists. But Facebook, one of my old professors or one of my friends will post an article and we'll all read that article and we'll joke around and stuff, but there'll be some fairly detailed conversation and commentary go on in the comments section that is an extent, and this is a conversation that we would have over a bottle of wine if we were all in the same place. We're just not. But what's interesting to me is that there are a few relationships I have online where this person didn't go to our school, but they have enough connections to people who did, and they have enough that reference point
part of that conversation
that they kind of get – they become okay, part okay. of the community, and I actually friend them and find myself talking to them
all
about
right, this. All right. So it's true, right, that human beings can connect with one another through media.
Right.
Right. And this has happened over thousands of years where people write letters back and forth right. to one another. And in a certain sense, the internet is a kind of really quick way of writing a letter to somebody.
Right.
Right. So it almost has the appearance of having a conversation. Right. And talking on the telephone, right, is more like having a real conversation with somebody. And talking on Skype
right.
is even better than talking on the telephone. Right. So you can see the other person. But what is it that's yeah. different between face-to-face style communication and communicating through a medium? What's the essential difference? I mean, you Man. Can't touch the other person. You can't make eye contact really, even on right. Skype. You can't smell their breath. What else is – what's the essential difference there?
I think it's the okay, obviously we are built for by nature for face-to-face communication through verbal speech. And then when you take that and that is the kind of the first distribution of cognition. You think of something and then you form it into words that are sounds that someone else's ears pick up. Right, and then that's outside of your head, right? That's kind of where we're designed for, right?
Okay.
Now, when you take it once, you put that next step in and you write it down, you distribute the cognition and then you hand it to them and you leave and then they read it, that becomes one step less personal.
Right, right, so which is why all the great teachers, so going back all through Western history, all of the great teachers all prefer verbal discourse, spoken oral discourse
right.
over the written word. So, for example, Jesus never wrote anything.
Right. Nor did Socrates.
Socrates never wrote anything. And there's something very significant about that.
No, I'm with you. Now, here's what's interesting, though, is that through the modern media, you brought up Skype, or like I use FaceTime.
Sure. As I'm, or Google Hangout.
Yeah. So when my friend Ann, who I went to college with, and we've had just 1,000 conversations face-to-face, sometimes we'll email back and forth, talk on Facebook, but then she'll shoot me a text and go, "Hey, you want to FaceTime?" And I'm like, "Yeah, let's do it." There's something in me. My heart quickens a little bit. I'm like, "Oh, I get to see Ann. I've been talking to her, exchanging information all the time." But then when I sit down, I make sure I'm wearing a decent shirt. I'm, I make sure that it's not too dark in the room. And then you hit play, and it's like, and you see that person, and they're moving, and they're reacting to what you're saying. You're like, "Hey, what's up?" I mean, you feel, and what that is we are built to be face to face. That is by nature. So anything that brings us back to there through analog or whatever, I think that email is way more human. Now, I think I'm a big fan of letter writing, but it's a literary craft. It's not the same thing. I think emailing and texting, I'll defend it. It is more like conversation because it's quick and it's spontaneous and it's the immediate reaction to what was just said. And so I think that the faster the media gets and the more immediate the media gets, the more human
it gets. And I feel exactly the opposite.
Okay.
And what I mean by this is I think people have lost the ability to think long thoughts.
That's true.
Right? So people read 800-word articles on the internet rather than reading books about a subject.
I'm with you. I agree with that.
And people write 2-sentence emails rather than writing a 2-page letter, which conveys a lot of helpful and useful information and color and background and backstory. And so to me, it seems like what's happened is rather than reducing our amount of correspondence, we've increased it and we've atomized it. So rather than getting a letter from, say, a partner or whatever in another city that makes, say, 10 points and asks 3 questions, now you get 13 emails.
Right.
One for every single point. Whenever it came to that person's mind, they typed you an email and sent it to you. Mm-hmm. And then 3 for those questions. That's crazy and inefficient, I think. It depends on the style of business that you're doing, right? Some business is very fast-paced, and you need to have super fast communication, thinking of like investing, for example.
No, but what I'm saying—
But not all business is that fast-paced, or needs to be.
But what I'm saying is that it seems to me that things like text messaging, quick, fast emails back and forth, instant messaging, etc., is less like that, like the long letter writing and thinking big thoughts. But those things were less natural to man. Those were almost a literary craft to think out that long. It's not like we've established and agreed that conversation is kind of what we're built for. And text messages and quick emails back and forth are more like conversation. Now, it's not more like conversation with me because I write a big long letter with my words and you sit there and stare at me and then start making gestures to let you talk. But most people don't talk like me. So most people quick, fast, back and forth.
You know, actually a great early example of this would be in the Civil War, right? When Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis are communicating with their generals, not only via letter carriers, but also through the telegram.
Right.
And it's fascinating to just read some of the things that, you know, are being sent over the telegram by those generals and Lincoln and Davis. And but because they were the first people in a certain sense to have access to that technology. And now everybody has access to it. But I don't think it's necessarily made us smarter or better.
I think it's just making us, in some ways it's making us different. And I think that we are losing something. In fact, it's funny, I've started a project where, you know, we've done my, with the check interview that we did that day, I gave you my hack for my pen.
Yeah.
So I've gotten into like writing instruments and paper. And my next thing is I'm going to get my own little byline, my own little like little logo and my name and stuff, and have stationery printed and have matching little envelopes. And I'm going to surprise my friends. I'm going to start writing letters again. Just writing out longhand letters again.
We'll see how long that lasts.
And then sending them to people because I know how much, but it's an act of it's a craft. It's a literary action.
Okay.
That's why it feels so special when you get one, right? Because you're like, oh, someone wrote me a little 3-page book.
Yeah.
Someone wrote me this thing. Someone took the same skill that you would use to write a book and wrote 3 pages of it, and it's only for me.
All right.
That feels really special.
I want to backpedal something really quickly before we end here, and that is, why is it that young people in our generation or whatever are not joining all these associations and things?
They're boring.
If face-to-face communication is the primary way of going about business as a human being, why are young people joining digital communities rather than face-to-face communities?
Because I think that people, for all the talk about diversity in the modern world, my generation, Gen X, Gen Y, and the millennials, we don't like diversity. We like the idea of diversity, but we like to be with people like us that agree with us. So Democrats hang out with Democrats, Republicans making out with Republicans. As I harp on all the time, Lord knows Catholics love their bubble. And you and me, we don't want to go to the Kiwanis. We want to be Catholic. And are you Catholic? I'm super Catholic. Are you going to Catholic thing up at the Catholic place? I'm going to that Catholic thing right after we get done with the Catholic thing. Are you going to that other Catholic thing? I mean, that's what we do. We like to group ourselves by ideology into tribes and then hang out with people like us. If you go to the Kiwanis...
You're going to have to deal with
the Democrat guy. You're a Republican. You have to deal with a Democrat guy that is blue collar, and you're a Republican businessman, or vice versa. So, they don't want to hang out together.
But this wasn't the same mentality that our forebears had.
No,
right?
No.
They valued, or maybe they had more in common with each other than we have with other people at our age.
I think that's why there was more of a common culture.
Right.
And so there was less variables for tribes to align along.
Right, right.
I mean, does that make sense?
No, it does.
I think that there wasn't.
I mean, think of it just like before,
fashion and culture.
Before
and,
the internet, everybody has access to the same information, right, in the local newspaper or whatever. And so there's just a very limited amount of stuff.
I'm old enough to remember being a kid before cable. And there are X amount of channels and X amount of things on, and everybody watched TV at night. So when you go to the water cooler or school
next day, you could talk about what was on last night,
and everybody watched it.
Right.
Now you've got, out of my 1,000 Facebook friends, I've got my 30 of them that are hardcore Marvel comics nerds. And whenever we see the new episode of Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., after what happened in Captain America the Winter Soldier in the movie, everybody's all geeking out and talking about it. But it's just us because we watched that.
Right.
Probably the bulk of them didn't see that because there's 500 channels.
You wouldn't have been able to do that kind of thing before Facebook or whatever.
No. And that's why I'm saying that it's a different kind of community. But here's something that I care about that is, for whatever stupid reason, I geek out over. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. Turns out he was a bad guy. Oh, my goodness. Right? And then I can talk to the other 10 friends that I have, my friend Jason in North Carolina, my other friend in California, and we could talk about, oh my gosh, did you see what happened? And we can instantaneously have a conversation because of the new digital media.
I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, is that a higher value than getting to know your next door neighbor?
It's funny. I just don't know
that it is.
That's a good conversation because we talked about this before when we talk about the urbanism, about people. And it's funny. You brought up something that's changed my life. Not changed my life, but made me notice something. And that is that we used to build front porches and now we build back decks.
Right.
And I've got both. And I've started noticing what mood I'm in and what I want and which one I go to sit on and read and have a cup of coffee or a glass of wine. And it's funny, a year and a half ago when I moved into this neighborhood, I live in a tight urban neighborhood.
Right, which we talked about last
time. We've actually gotten to know the neighbors.
Right.
Now, we haven't hung out in a while, but when we first moved there, we were actually having barbecues with the neighbors and hanging out, playing. They'd hear us playing music and go, hey, you mind if we come over? Hey, come on over. And they'd walk around the fence.
But now you're so busy watching Marvel Comics on TV and Facebooking your friends from college from whoever knows how many years ago that you're not able to get to know your neighbors.
But that being said, actual examples, I will use my text messaging or even Facebook to interface with people that live locally and get together. We do that all the time. I mean, all the people in the Institute here that hang out, like Perry's got a show coming up this weekend where I was Facebooking about it today, that I will end up seeing people that I kind of see sometimes in the cafe weekend at a show because of the new digital media.
So it means that we can, in some ways, combine face-to-face and digital community.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to choose one or the other. right?
Right.
And ideally, right, we're using digital community to supplement face-to-face community. We're not all atomized, you know, people living in our own little boxes, just communicating with people via social media.
And you can write that letter that you wanted with the 10 points and the 3 questions in the one big fat email and send it to someone. You save a stamp, you save a tree, and they get it quick, and then they can spend the afternoon writing you back. I mean, you can do that. People just don't.
Right.
It's a tool. It's how you use it.
Yeah. So I don't know if we've necessarily solved anything about digital community versus face-to-face community, church membership, and the Kiwanis Club.
Solve?
But we've at least explored it. I think that there's a lot more here that we should talk about at some point in the future.
I think so, too.
But I do think that there's a huge difference between the way our fathers and grandfathers related with one another in these associations and the way our generation is behaving, and that we don't quite understand what that means yet.
I'm with you.
But it's somehow related to the Facebooking, Twittery world of social media.
I think that this form of community and whether or not it augments or takes away from is in the awkward teenage phase.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's not mature yet.
It's not mature yet. I think that the same way that when you watch like Downton Abbey or something, that they're like, this telephone is going to be an interruption.
Right.
We're going to be living our life and we'll have to stop everything and answer this damn thing. Right? They had a servant to answer it, but it was going to be an interruption. Right? Now, yeah, you know what? But I drive my friends nuts because I will turn my ringer off. I don't live with my cell phone on 24/7.
Yeah.
When the shop's open, I do because there's something could blow up. But this weekend, we're closed as of now, won't reopen until Tuesday.
Ringer's off.
I'll turn the ringer off for entire afternoons.
Yeah.
And read a book and do something else because it's actually de-stressing to me. I wish I made enough money to take off for a month and shut it all off for a while.
Well, don't we all? Well, while all of you are dreaming
well,
about
when this podcast
taking a month off and perhaps joining your local professional association or civic club, Andrew and I will probably be having a cup of coffee and arguing about something over the counter.
Over the counter. There you go.
This is the end of episode 11 of Over the Counter Podcast. I'm Mark Eastcheck.
And I am Andrew Whaley.